Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Bracketology Podcast right here on CrimsonCast.com. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Bracket Racket, 2 hours of college basketball talk starting now, running through 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Glad to have you joining us as we get set for a review of the first few days of the college basketball season. A lot of things to talk about, some interesting things, some good things, a lot of stuff on the court, some things that, frankly, are head-scratchers, and we've got a lot of issues we need to sort through here over these next 2 hours. So we're looking forward to doing that. We hope that you enjoy the show. Please feel free to give us a call at any point during the proceedings. 626-696-8557 is the number, and we'll put your call on the air. You can also tweet at us at CrimsonCast or at HoopsHD. Joined, as always, by at least some of my regular compatriots. We will be without Lee Delvecchio for a little while. I think he'll be joining us for the second half of the show. But David Griggs, a stalwart on the program, joining us tonight and every night. David, how you doing this evening?
Better than South Florida. Wow.
Yes.
You know, beautiful new arena, you know, rivalry game, big crowd. Everything went right except how they played.
Which is kind of a key component, as I think some teams are starting to find that out. Like, you have to play well. Several teams have fallen prey to that here over the past couple of days. But we will talk about the Bulls in more detail a little bit later on in the show. But, yes, they definitely have some head-scratching to do, I think. Kyle Lamb also joining us on the program this evening. Kyle, what's shaking?
Well, I am doing better than the welfare of college basketball being played over the open seas. That is for sure.
That is a very good point, and you know, it's an issue that we've been told we have to wait to talk about until Lee gets into the podcast. So we're going to have to postpone that till the second hour, but we just might make that our issue of the week because it seems like a pretty important issue. Like this whole idea of, you know, not playing important games outside so that they can either start or finish might seem like a good idea for future organizers of these things.
You would think.
Yeah.
I know a week or two ago we were talking about, you know, how we thought the novelty was great and wanting to play at places like Rucker Park or more gimmick-type games. But that was basically – I don't think any of us said that we wouldn't have done that without some sort of a backup plan.
Right.
The ideas
are nice, but, you know, whenever you bring the elements into the equation – you have to account for the fact that they might do something to the proceedings. You can't just say, oh, yeah, no, it won't, no problems. There won't be any problems here at all. You can't do that. I mean, so a lot of lack of foresight. We'll talk about that a little later on as, you know, frankly, I think it was embarrassing to college basketball what happened this weekend. And, you know, all the best intentions, whatever, the road to hell is paved with them. And that's what happened in a couple of cases here over the last couple of days. But we'll talk about that here coming up. Let's give you an overview of what we're going to talk about on the show, folks. We will be talking about the outdoor basketball situation that we saw transpire. We'll also be talking about each of the first 3 days of college basketball that we've seen thus far, Friday, Saturday, and then today. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to work in backwards order. So we'll go ahead and start with what we've seen so far today, and then move backwards through Saturday and then through Friday. Obviously, we're getting our first look at some teams right now. And, Kyle, I saw you posted something. I think it was on Twitter. And I thought it was a little premature, but I'm curious to hear your reasoning for it. You said something along the lines of the opening salvo of games has led you to believe we're just not going to have a dominant team in college basketball this year. What is it that's making you feel that way right now?
Well, it's kind of a combination of predisposition to what I expected coming into the season, and also what I've seen. Now, it is early, and as you said, it's almost, I mean, it's probably premature, but I'm also basing it more just, not just off of what we saw this weekend, but what, you know, what I'm expecting. It's just, I think that we're, I don't know, I just look around college basketball, I look at rosters, and I look at teams, and with all due respect to Indiana and Louisville, you know, I look at the roster of these two teams, and in an ordinary year of college basketball, I'm not sure that these are the type of teams that we'd be considered the best two in the country. And to be honest, it's like we've had this conversation before, but I mean, I think they're deserving of their ranking, at least, you know, relative to if anybody's deserving of a ranking at this point. But it's just, I just don't know that there's any, but I don't know that there's a lot of talent this year. Last year, you know, we had four or five, you know, players that came back for their sophomore and junior years that we probably weren't expecting. And this year, I think with a lot of those players gone this year, and maybe the freshman class as a whole not being as strong, I think the rosters at the top of the heap in college basketball are down a little bit. So I don't see any teams jumping out at me as being great teams this year. I think Indiana right now is probably the most complete team, but I'm not sure that that's saying a lot. And Louisville today, obviously, it's just their first game, but I mean, man, they just they struggled to score points today. And to be honest, it wasn't just them. I mean, North Carolina had two games this weekend where they struggled. Ohio State, you know, took them, you know, probably 15, 20 minutes to really get out of the gate against Albany. Just a lot of teams today having problems. And I know that that's not terribly, you know, uncommon for the first weekend of the year, but it just, I don't know, it seems exacerbated this year.
We've actually added Lee Delvecchio to the podcast here. Lee, welcome. You want to just jump right in and either agree or disagree with what Kyle just said there?
No, I agree completely with what he says, and good to talk to you, Jump, again. I mean, it's just every time I was changing the channel this weekend, it was just another performance when I just was like, huh, because it wasn't what I expected from some of the top teams. Now, because of my own personal schedule, I didn't get to watch as much. I actually watched more basketball on Friday than I did on Saturday, than I did on Sunday. But, you know, from what I saw today, I watched a little bit of North Carolina. And, you know, we can't be drawing too many conclusions from game one. But they did struggle. And you could say the same thing about, I mean, Arizona. You know, they're struggling with Charleston Southern, you know, today last I saw. And, you know, their star freshman Caleb Tarczewski hasn't really done much of anything. So, you know, it is early. We can't draw too much from these games, but I really liked Kyle's point about how it's 1-2 to the year. Because other than Indiana, I would make the argument that this Indiana team would be a highly ranked team most years, but it just doesn't feel like the same level of teams at the top that we've seen in the past few years. And I wonder if that's just a coincidence or if it's indicative of something larger.
David, go ahead.
Well, I just think that great teams are defined by the great things that they do, and great players are defined by the great things that they do. It's hard to do something great, you know, between the start of the season and now. I mean, most teams have only played one game. I get what they're saying, but I'm not ready to say that there's no dominance. I mean, who's to say that somebody's not going to come out of nowhere and impress everyone? You know, the back-to-back championships that Florida won, no one was looking at them at the start of the 05-06 season. So I guess, again, like the cue ball, or the pool balls are racked and the cue ball just hit them. Like the season hasn't even taken shape yet. And who's to say that there are or there are not? I'm just not ready. It's the beginning of the season. It seems to me that we go through this at the beginning of every year. There's no good teams. There's no dominant teams. There could be, and we just don't know who it is yet.
Well, and I look at it from the perspective of, you know, obviously, okay, so I'm coming at it from the perspective of someone who's watching Indiana a great deal, and I agree with what Lee said in that I think this Indiana team would be highly ranked most years just because of the type of personnel that they've got and the pieces they've got, at least in the first game, look like they're going to fit pretty well. I mean, they won that game by 40 points. I don't know what else people are expecting out of them. They looked more impressive in that game than Louisville did against Manhattan. But by the same token, I think that it is interesting when you were trying to figure out what's going on here in these first couple of weeks, there's always going to be sloppiness. There's always going to be a little bit of awkwardness in terms of a lot of these squads and how they're meshing with each other. I tend to suspend any sort of consideration of what's going on with college basketball teams, especially at the top, until we get past the Thanksgiving tournaments, because then at least in most cases we've seen these teams go up against one or two decent to good competitors, and we get a better sense of what they can handle. And yeah, I really think doing it before then just seems a little bit premature in terms of of saying whether we are or not going to have a really consistent top five or top ten.
I look at it this way: if you look at Indiana right now, other than Cody Zeller, I'll give a nod to potential for Yogi Ferrell, because I mean, although I'm not sure how his game is going to translate to the next level, but other than Cody Zeller, do you see anybody on this Indiana roster that you see being a future first-round pick? I mean, besides Zeller.
I mean, I think a lot of it depends on how they play this year. I think that there's two players on Indiana's roster that could increase their draft stock to the late first round. Okay, I think that if Christian Watford adds a rebounding and defensive game to his already impressive offensive game, teams could look at him in the late first round. I mean, he's an athletic 6'9 guy. And I think Victor Oladipo, if he picks up a shot along the way this year, might end up somewhere in that same category. So a lot of it depends, again, on how the season goes for those two, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility in either case.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Go ahead.
My question for the group is, do you recall a time in the past preceding the Thanksgiving and the exempt tournaments where you saw a game and you were like, wow, I mean, you were just blown away by the quality of play and, man, this team is really good? I mean, you see a lot of slop at this time in the year, and I agree that it is sloppy, but I guess I'm just not ready to subscribe to the fact that nobody's dominant.
Well, I mean, see, I disagree. I mean, there's been times – I'll use a couple examples. I mean, 2 years ago, Ohio State came out and went into Florida and won by 18 points on the road. I mean, last year, Ohio State beat Duke by 25 points.
Well, were those games the first week of the season? I can't remember.
Well, the Florida game was. Okay.
Well, I don't think we've had – who's had the opportunity to play a game like that thus far, I guess, is my question.
Well, see, that's –
that's the thing. They haven't played that type of game even against – I mean, Indiana, I guess, did a little bit more, but, I mean, some of these other teams have not played a game even against, suspect competition. They haven't played a game like that.
I agree, I think you could say Miami or North Carolina State did. I mean, they looked pretty impressive in their victory over Miami on Friday. You know, I mean, there were a couple of other teams that I think overall looked pretty impressive. I mean, if we're going to start talking like that, Gonzaga looked very impressive. In their first game, they hung 103 points on Southern Utah. I mean, so
Xavier's
I don't know.
The one seed. I mean,
yeah, that's right. So I don't know. I really want to wait a couple of weeks before we get into saying that we're devoid of typically, overly talented teams that would rule the landscape from above. I just don't know if we may or may not have that. I just think that this is kind of a curious year because it might take a week or two for some of these teams to really mesh.
Yeah, okay, and in fairness, I do want to remind you that I did admit from the get-go some of this is based on preconceived ideas too, so it's not I'm not just basing on what little we've seen thus far. It partially was based on a preconceived notion. So I fully admit that maybe my preconceived beliefs are shaping what I've seen thus far.
And that's fair. Lee, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is almost what I don't like about these early season matchups. I mean, we're all about creating an atmosphere for the sport. But at the same time, it's almost absurd that in 4 months we're going to be looking for out-of-conference stuff, but we're going to be pointing – well, thanks to DuPont, we won't have as many options, but we're going to be pointing to out-of-conference matchups. And when you think about it, it's almost absurd to be either using as a plus or holding against, like San Diego State Syracuse. It is ridiculous if that game even gets discussed for either team's seeding. But if you're looking throughout a conference, especially for Syracuse, it's going to jump right to the top. And it's the worst possible time to have those teams playing. And yet that's the game that you know is going to get all the attention on the resume.
We did have a question. Go ahead. I'm sorry, David.
Well, I think this goes back to something we talked about a week or two ago of the issue in the week. It's too early. There hasn't been enough practice. There's not enough interest. These arenas are half full. And like Lee just said, like these are games that in the end, we're going to look at some of these to determine seeding and overall strength. And, it, yeah, they're not a good – just to build on what he said, I completely agree.
We did have a question in chat which kind of relates to this, and I'll let Kyle take this because I have an idea of what his answer is going to be. But Jake Lorton in chat saying, am I the only one that thinks this year's IU team could be better than last year's UK team? IU was UK's toughest challenge last year, and IU got vastly better this year. Kyle, go ahead.
Can I just defer this question?
No. I'm actually curious to hear your evaluation.
No, I don't see any possibility of Indiana being that kind of team. That Kentucky team last year had, I mean, it goes without saying they had five first round NBA picks. I mean, I think that speaks for itself. But more than that, where Cody Zeller is a very good offensive player and a good rebounder. He is not the type of defensive player that Anthony Davis is. I shouldn't even have to say that, but I think it bears repeating because Anthony Davis was a game changer defensively. I mean, he just completely, when he was on the floor, he changed everything that the opposing teams did. And Cody Zeller, like I said, he's a good offensive player, but he is not that type of impact player. I think that Kentucky team last year, I mean, even when they're playing bad, I mean, they could sleepwalk through a game. And, I mean, we saw that at Mississippi State. They sleepwalked through basically 36 minutes of that game and still won by, I believe, double digits because they were just that much talented. Now, in fairness, Rodney Hood did miss most of the second half for Mississippi State, so I wonder if he had stayed on the floor if that would have been different. But not to get off track here, but my point is that Kentucky team, they had five NBA guys for a reason. And so, I don't think the ceiling is anywhere near that high for Indiana.
I would tend to agree, and I guess I look at it from the perspective of what made Kentucky good last year to the degree that they were wasn't just that they were a very good basketball team with skilled players, but they were incredibly athletic, a lot more athletic than this IU team is. I mean, and it wasn't just Davis. You know, there's no analog for Michael Kidd-Gilchrist on this Indiana team this year. Now, I think IU has arguably better all-around offensive talent, maybe at four of the five positions if you were to put them up against Kentucky last year. But I think Kentucky's defensive abilities will set them apart. And I think that's the one question mark that's still out there really on this Indiana team, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, is – nobody's really sure how they're going to perform defensively. They were adequate last year, but adequate isn't going to win you a national title. Kentucky was an excellent defensive team last year, and they did win a national title largely as a result of that. So I think that it's way early to even be making those comparisons because we don't know how that's going to shake out. But I do think that the difference between this year's Indiana team and last year's Kentucky team primarily lies on the defensive end. And I think even if Indiana got markedly better defensively, I still don't think they would touch what that Kentucky team was able to do. So as we move on, let's look at some of these individual games that we looked at over the course of the weekend. The games going on today, I said we'd start at the beginning and work our way back, but in large part that was because I didn't think Lee was going to be here. So let's go ahead and switch it up and start on Friday now and move forward to Saturday and Sunday after that. So they knock off Bryant 97-54, and that was one of those games that I was there for. It wasn't really a contest. Indiana was a little bit sloppy, but they did what you wanted to see them do in that sort of a game, which was basically they stepped on Bryant's throat and they didn't let them up. Other games outside of the main one that we're going to talk about, Michigan with a big win over Slippery Rock, 100-62. Not much was learned there. NC State beating Miami of Ohio, really handling 97-59. The first game that I really wanted to concentrate on, which was a bit surprising, and it actually involves Kentucky, who we were just talking about, at the Barclays Center Classic, I guess it was officially called, Kentucky 72, Maryland 69. David, were you surprised that the game was as close as it was down the stretch?
Honestly, not at all. I mean, I was expecting, I was expecting a very sloppy game, and that's what it was. I thought Maryland might have a chance. But Kentucky has all those freshmen, all those new players, and they hadn't played in a real game yet of any sort of consequence. And if you watched it, it was slop ball. I wasn't that surprised. I think Kentucky is going to continue to gel and get much better than that. But at this time of the year, whenever you have a young team, no matter how talented it is, where nothing, when nothing about it has any experience or returning, it's new to everyone. It's not just a new part. It's a new appliance made up entirely of new parts. I mean, it's not going to work right away. I wasn't that surprised.
Lee, your thoughts on this game?
I thought it was interesting watching Kyle Beecher, of all people, you know, who everyone expected to be the player to take over for Kentucky. He was really great. In fact, it was interesting watching him just look at Nerlens Noel set a bad screen and just decide to dribble around a bad screen instead of trying to make something happen. It was good enough for him to drive to the hoop. I think for Maryland, what killed them was just they were so terrible shooting the basketball. They missed, I want to say, their first 17 three-pointers. The first half, they were 13 of 44 from the field. And meanwhile, in the first half, Kentucky was 18 of 31, and that was really kind of a talent issue. You know, Kentucky didn't execute very well, but the talent they have is such a high level that that's why they got out to a big lead. And then Maryland put a big run on them in the second half, really got the crowd into it. And that, I mean, once Maryland, you know, showed any sort of offensive execution, it really became a game, but they were just so terrible. I don't know if I can take too much away from it as a positive Kentucky performance as much as, you know, people look at the score and think, wow, Maryland, great job. No, I actually thought if they were just marginally decent, they should win that game. I mean, it's a missed opportunity for Maryland more than anything, in my opinion, they finished 3 of 19 from 3. I mean, that might win you the ACC, but that's more of a statement on the ACC than actually being very good.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the situation is with both of those teams as we go forward. I mean, the Kentucky obviously does have a lot of new pieces that they're trying to integrate, but I was surprised they had as much trouble integrating as they did, at least in this contest.
Well, to put this in perspective, and Lee touched on it a little bit, but Kentucky only won that game because of the heroics of walk-on Jared Polson. I mean, think about that for a second. Yeah. I mean, one could say, well, you know, that bodes well for Kentucky that they're getting contributions for Jared Polson. On the other hand, I take the opposite approach. I think that's a bad sign. If they need Jared Polson to win them games this year, they're in a lot of trouble, and they're not going to live up to their number three ranking because, they recruited Ryan Harrow to come in as a transfer and be, you know, an electrifying, you know, game-changing point guard, and they didn't even – I mean, to show you what they thought of him, he was on the bench the last 10 minutes of that game, and they needed Jared Polson to pull that game out for them. That was, like Lee said, I didn't come away thinking Maryland played great. I came away thinking, you know, if they had even half of a pulse with their perimeter game, they should have won that game. And they weren't, you know, they fumbled the ball down the stretch, and Kentucky was able to seal the game with free throws. Well, no thanks to, you know, Willie Carlson and Nerlens Noel, because they were, you know, awful from the free throw line. But, yeah, that was not, you know, if you're just based on that game alone, that's not a good sign for Kentucky, because they looked disjointed and just completely, you know, it didn't look like they knew what they wanted to do.
Here's all you need to know. They sealed the game at the line in a game in which they shot 18 of 28 at the line.
where was that during the Sweet 16 last year? But anyway.
That was March. This is November, and you can't stop Jared. You can't stop Jared Polson. You can only hope to contain him.
And it is literally a completely different team.
Yes, it is. It is a completely different team. Absolutely. Anyway, Let's jump over to Germany. UConn 66, Michigan State 62. Although I don't know how they could tell, because the uniforms for both teams were basically incomprehensible. This was like one of those patterns they show people who are colorblind. You know, where you see if you can, like, see a six form in the thing. I could not tell. I was sitting in a bar watching this game about 20 feet from the television. I had no clue who was scoring or what the hell was going on. But
that's actually the motto for UConn's basketball program this year.
Well, Lee, obviously you're a vested interest in this game. What did you come away from this game thinking and feeling?
Well, I expected UConn to, in a best-case scenario, play hard but lose by five or six. So I am pleasantly stunned with the performance they put in. They came right out of the gates. Jay jumped all over Michigan State, and I don't know if the camouflage lulled Michigan State into a false sense of what team they were playing, because UConn as a team finished with 10 blocks, a fact that should single-handedly cost the Spartans two seed lines in March. I know we shouldn't draw conclusions, but that is a pathetic job by Michigan State. When Tyler Olander and DeAndre Daniels combined for 7 blocks, something is wrong, and Michigan State had better hope this is their patented early season swoon, because Derek Nix was terrible. He finished with 11 rebounds but was 1 for 5 from the field. He can now shoot free throws. That's the good news. The bad news is he can't shoot anything else. Meanwhile, for UConn, they were led by Shabazz Napier, who had 25 points. Ryan Boatwright looked like he turned his ankle really bad, but he played through it, and he said postgame, this could just be braggadocio or, you know, false sense of anything, but he said, how could I leave that game with a bad ankle when, you know, they had spent 3 days on the base visiting the Wounded Warriors. Now, a lot of that, you know, could be drama, but it is at least he seems to have, you know, his head in the right place. It was just a great performance by UConn. They actually got productivity out of Enosh Wolf, which was stunning. They have the transfer point guard from Holy Cross, R.J. Evans, who looks like Carlos Boozer's head placed on Khalid El-Amin's body, which is a combination I never thought was humanly possible. And when he's in the game, he is a graduate student, but he does literally look 10 years older than everyone else on the court. Because it's a very young UConn team. Omar Calhoun, no relation, is the big freshman they have coming in. He didn't make a field goal. And if you had told me Calhoun wouldn't score, Enosh Wolf was and Tyler Olander got significant minutes in the front court, I would ask how many dozen was UConn down by. But they, for the first 25 minutes of that game or so, were able to run at will at Michigan State. And then they just had to hold on down the stretch because they really were out of gas for the last 15 minutes. They don't have any bench to speak of this year for a variety of reasons. But it was just a great win. It was seriously, as a UConn alum, one of the five most enjoyable regular season wins I've really ever had, because I am absolutely shocked that they won that game. I had no expectation that they could maybe even compete. I'm pleasantly stunned.
Now, of course,
I said in our email thread the other night that Michigan State is right in line for a Final Four appearance, because this is their typical, first game, second game, terrible appearance where they lose. They look like they're not even a top 25 team. And of course, you know, by March, they're going to end up making a tournament run. But no, in seriousness, though, I do want to add, you know, to what Lee was saying. I was extremely impressed with Shabazz Napier and Ryan Boatwright. I thought those two just completely dictated the pace of that game. They were, you know, Michigan State's biggest weakness the past several years has been handling the ball in the backcourt, and those two were just a nuisance in the perimeter. Michigan State was never able to get into their offense that game because of those two defensively. And they ran the show offensively. Connecticut has absolutely no margin for error this year because of the depth and because of a lack of a real, you know, front court, you know, scorer. But those two will win them some games they shouldn't win, because I really think they are that good.
And I'll say this, as happy as I am and very impressed with Kevin Ollie in his first game, how you don't manage to get Leon Tolksdorf a couple of minutes in a game, he's from Berlin and you're playing in Germany. I don't know. I think it was, I mean, I'm sure that the idea was, well, it wouldn't be this kind of a game. I don't think anybody involved with UConn, including Jim Calhoun, from everything he said, including Kevin Ollie, had any idea they could actually win this game. So I was a little disappointed Tolksdorf didn't get in. But otherwise, yeah, they showed a lot of poise. And, you know, this was the good Shabazz Napier. And Kyle, as you know, that is not a consistent expectation to have.
Yeah, we've seen too many games of bad Shabazz, and I think he knows this year that it's his team for better or worse, and
yeah.
I'm not sure that's a good thing, but he knows it's his team now.
And the lack of any expectations, because they can't go anywhere, is probably only going to help him. The thing for me will be next year when they can go to places, if he is as free and easy, when they have to remind him that there are tournament bids at stake.
Right. Anyway, we need to move on. We can only devote so much of the show to UConn basketball.
I disagree. The all-time winningest program in Western Europe. It's UConn and the United States Army tied.
That is not true. IU did a tour of Western Europe back in 1985, and they won a bunch of games there. So
were they regular season games?
It doesn't matter. You didn't specify. You did not specify. Anyway,
anybody as tough as Michigan State. All right, we'll move on.
They played Serbia when it wasn't Serbia. Anyway, we need to go to South Alabama, Florida State. I'm going to throw this one to David. You weren't surprised by Maryland, Kentucky. Were you surprised by Florida State, South Alabama?
Very much so. As Clark Griswold told his brother-in-law in Christmas Vacation, if I woke up with my head sewn to the carpet, I would be less surprised than I would have been had South Alabama beaten Florida State. And part of it is, I was really big on this Florida State team, and by no means is the year over. They could still have a big year. You know, I love their size. I liked a lot of their talent. I just thought they were going to be really good, and it was set up for them. And South Alabama, coming out of the Sun Belt, they weren't even expected to be a force in the Sun Belt. I mean, the teams that everyone's looking at are Middle Tennessee, North Texas, maybe Western Kentucky a little bit, a team that blew a game. But, I mean, they were a mid-level team in a weak league, and they go to Florida State, and they beat them. I was shocked. I mean, it was probably...
Well, I wasn't shocked. I mean, I was shocked in as much as it happened, but you look at the stats, and this is the problem with this Florida State team. It's why I can't ever take them seriously. Every game is a rock fight. They shoot 41% at home, 5 for 21 from 3. They let South Alabama get the same number of rebounds that they did in the game. They got out-assisted by South Alabama. It's remarkable to me that, you know, they just, for whatever reason, when it comes to important games in the regular season at least, they just don't seem to be able to put it together. And, you know, you got Michael Snare, 2 for 11 from the field, Akara White, 3 for 8, Terry Wisenant, 3 for 7, Ian Miller, 2 for 7. You're not going to win games. I don't care who you're playing if you're shooting like that.
Well,
you're right. And I guess I was surprised by all that. Like, how is it for – and part of it is just me misdiagnosing or assessing the team. How is it that they struggled that much against what, from all accounts, appear to be a mid-level Sun Belt team?
Right.
This
is not a South Alabama team we're expecting to do great things this year, I don't think.
Right.
So, go ahead.
This wasn't a case of one player either leading them to an upset. The thing that shocked me is that 5 South Alabama players scored in double figures. How does that happen?
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of the Maryland-Kentucky game in the sense that Florida State, as bad as they played, if they were just remotely competent shooting the three ball, they still win this game.
Right.
But they wouldn't have deserved it. And, I mean, they shot 22 of 32 at the line. They South Alabama, I mean, they hit 9 of 15 from three, but you can't be giving up double-digit games to an entire starting lineup's worth of South Alabama Jaguars. That's not a recipe for success in the Atlantic Coast Conference.
Absolutely not. And that's, I think, one of the more surprising results that we had on Friday. Not the only surprising one, though. A couple other big conference teams lost at home in somewhat embarrassing fashion. Kyle, you've been kind of high on this Purdue team coming into the year, but they lose 70-65 to Bucknell in a game where they actually outshot Bucknell, but they let Bucknell out-rebound them, and just not a good performance overall from the Boilermakers in this game.
No, it wasn't. In fairness, this is a Bucknell team that, last year they were a very good team, and, if memory serves me correctly, they return, if not... I want to say,
everybody.
If not all of, yeah, I want to say that they
all
return
of
all of their scoring.
All of it, yeah.
So, I mean, people are going to look at this and think that this is a big upset, but I'm really not sure it was. And that's not to say that Purdue shouldn't be winning these games at home. But, I mean, this is a Bucknell team that, you know, they won 25 games last year. And as David said, they returned all of their – literally all of their scoring. So I don't think that this is going to be too much of an indictment against Purdue. But they are a young team, and they are going to have ups and downs like this. I know that they played – I believe they played today, and I think they won, you know, more comfortably. I can't remember who they were
Hofstra.
Playing. It wasn't
they were playing Hofstra,
okay. Yeah, last I saw, they were up like 28 in that game. So, I don't really think that this is going to be – I actually think Bucknell is going to be an at-large caliber team this year. So I think we're going to look back at this game in February and not look at it as a bad loss.
Yeah, if anything – I'm hoping it's a good win for Buck. I mean, to throw a little bracketology into it, like, this is a Bucknell team. Everybody remembers Lehigh that, beat Duke and then advanced to the round of 32. Well, this Bucknell team finished ahead of them in the Patriot standings and has everybody back. This is a team that is pushing for an at-large bid. And I really think that, like Kyle said, as the season moves on, this isn't going to be a bad loss for Purdue. It's going to be a good win for Bucknell. This
Bucknell
team is good.
We'll see. I'll withhold judgment for a little bit on that, but I still think that's a bad loss for Purdue regardless. I mean, they shot terribly throughout the game, 2-for-16 from the field, from three-point range. I just was expecting a little bit more out of the Boilermakers in that contest. Anyway, a couple other games from Friday that we need to talk about. UCLA starts off strong. They beat Indiana State pretty handily. I mean, they had a double-digit lead for most of that contest. They went 86-59. Of course, no Shabazz Muhammad, as he is ineligible for some period of time unknown in the future. But the Ware twins come out and score 17 and 13. Larry Drew manages the rare feat of scoring 1 point in 33 minutes of action. But Kyle Anderson looked good. 10 rebounds, 10 points, a good start for him. Don't know that we learned that much about UCLA, but we at least learned that they're going to be able to act as a functional unit, even without Muhammad out there. And then Lee, one I wanted to get to you on, George Mason knocks off Virginia in the first game for both teams, 63-59, and not the start Virginia wanted on the season, obviously.
Yeah, not what they were looking for in a season in which we are going to be desperately looking for someone to come out of the ACC besides the middle. I mean, maybe it's Maryland, maybe it's Virginia. It certainly didn't look like it was going to be Virginia based on what we saw in the Patriot Center on Friday night. They were not good. It was a style of game that really you would think played into their hands. It wasn't a high-scoring up-and-down affair, which is what George Mason would have wanted. But, I mean, Mason, surprising depth out of the Patriots. They got eight different players who registered a field goal, and they ended up holding Virginia to just, 40% from the field, which isn't great. But Mason shot almost 55% from the field. I mean, Virginia couldn't defend anything.
Right.
It was terrible. They were going to kill inside. They were going to kill outside. I mean, the rebound number is positive for Virginia, but Mason wasn't missing a whole lot of shots. I mean, there weren't a lot of opportunities there. And it was just I didn't think it was a terrible loss for Virginia, but it was a chance for them to really get a win that could have helped them out, down the line. And it just it didn't happen for them. I mean,
are we really looking at this Mason team as a team that's going to challenge for the Colonial title this year?
I don't know about challenge for the title, but I think they'll be at least okay. I mean, they'll still be good, I would think. Unless you think Paul Hewitt's
I can't trust Paul Hewitt. I really can't. Sorry, no. Especially, I mean, another year removed from, from having Larinaga's players on his roster. It just, I'm a little concerned that this could end up being a poor loss down the stretch for Virginia if they're, harboring any at-large aspirations. And I mean, they are a team we talked about at the beginning of the season as possibly, being an at-large bid team.
Well, I mean, they have Sherrod Wright, who's out of Mount Vernon, New York, which has produced a lot of great college players over the years. He had a great night for the Patriots. He was 6-for-9 from the field. He was their leading scorer. But at the same time, he only had 2 rebounds and 2 assists. And, if he's going to lead the way, they need somebody on the inside
right.
to make something happen for them. They don't have that, and yet they still were able
to really have their way with Virginia, which was kind of perplexing, if I'm honest.
Out of curiosity, do you trust Paul Hewitt or Frank Haith more?
I trust Frank Haith because he at least
do you like
mean,
root canals or having cheese?
Great question, Kyle. Not really a good choice you're giving me there, Mr. Lamb. But you know, I do like Haith a little bit more. Now, if you'd ask me who do I trust more, Paul Hewitt or Bruce Weber, I think that's a much more difficult question.
Well, when you say trust, do you mean as a trustworthy person or to have?
Yeah, I mean like, you know, do I trust him to go pick up my dry cleaning? Do I trust him to, you know, be able to, you know, do my taxes or something like that? Certainly not win a basketball game, though. I don't think they're competent
enough to pick up dry cleaning. They probably pick up the wrong suit.
To obey NCAA recruiting rules, well, I'm going to take Hewitt over Haith there. I'm afraid.
Okay, well, maybe on that. But anyway, go ahead, David. Last comment on this.
Yeah, earlier I had emphatically made the point that you can't read too much into what happens earlier in the season. Well, now I'm going to do a 180 and say, as far as the other Colonial teams, Mason by far was the most impressive. They played one of the better teams and had one of the better wins. Drexel goes out to Kent. Now, for those of you that don't know, Kent is not an easy place to win, but it's not quite as difficult when the place is half full, which it was. And Drexel, who I was so big on, needed this win on the road against what will probably be a top 100 team in Kent, and they didn't get it. I mean, it's hard. Can Mason win the Colonial? Well, judging by the first week, they can. Nobody, like, Delaware goes to LaSalle and loses. Drexel goes to Kent and loses.
Old Dominion lost to Holy Cross at home.
Yeah, so, I mean, Mason beats Virginia. I mean, so far, they're number one right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, fair enough. Anyway, let's...
You guys are all sleeping on Towson, I'm telling you.
And we'll continue to do so.
Towson
anyway,
is sleeping on Towson.
let's jump ahead and go ahead and go to Saturday, unless there's any other Friday games you guys wanted to mention that were particularly of note. Okay, let's move on then. So Saturday's game's not the impressive slate that we saw on Friday. And part of that was just because of the way the schedules fell. But a couple of games of note. Notre Dame starts off at home in what was the slugfest that we all expected against the Evansville Purple Aces. Neither team shot well. Evansville shot 31%. Notre Dame shot 40%. But Notre Dame was stronger in this game. Jack Cooley had 19 points. They win 58-49. This game just reminded me how much I want to avoid watching Notre Dame basketball this year.
This year?
Every year. It just I renewed my vows to that for this season after watching that game. But other games going on Saturday that were of note, there weren't that many. I mean, Missouri struggled a little bit in the first half, and they ended up finally pulling away from SIU Edwardsville. They win 83-69, so only a 14-point victory. Lawrence Bowers with 20 points, Phil Pressey with 19 points. Did you see things to be concerned about with Missouri in this game, Lee, or is this not that big of a deal?
I don't think it's a huge deal. That's probably because I think Missouri is going to – I think 15 is a little high for them this year. I think there's a bit of reversion to the mean coming their way this year.
Okay.
So I'm not stunned by this. There was an interesting under the radar game, but I'll wait on that if someone else has it. Do you have an idea where I'm going on this?
I'm thinking you're going to Tampa.
No, that wasn't it. That's a good one. But if someone else has a Missouri takeaway, I'll let them go with that first before we discuss the battle in Houston.
Kyle, any thoughts on that Missouri game that you'd like to share with us?
No, I was waiting for him to bring up the UCF South Florida game as well, and I'm a little.
So South Florida's reascent to the mountaintop of college basketball. It didn't have
it's
a great
nice
start.
Arena.
It is a very nice. They reopened the Sun Dome. They had 7,800. They had their big rival Central Florida in there, and South Florida got their doors blown clear off by Central Florida.
Bad, bad loss. What was it, 74-56,
and it wasn't nearly as close as the score would indicate. Central Florida led this game at halftime 40-24. Isaiah Sykes was just great. 10 of 16 from the floor with 11 rebounds. He was 26-11-8 assists. To say South Florida did not have an answer for him would be an insult to answers themselves. They were just terrible. Victor Rudd was 3 of 12. Anthony Collins was 2 of 8. It was just bad. South Florida did not have a good night at all. Thankfully for them, it is a long season, but it was not a good night. I mean, Isaiah Sykes, he was, as much as I'd love to just talk about how this was just a bad night for South Florida, they looked horrible. And I really want to give credit to Central Florida. They looked awesome. They looked like a team that's ready to jump in the Big East and compete this year. I mean, it's just one night. But they were clearly up for the rivalry game. They wanted to show that, you know, that they are at the same level of programming, even if they're in, you know, a different conference. And it was the Isaiah Sykes. I mentioned him. This is the guy that last year he was kind of a slow starter when they had the good start to the season. But as the season wore on, he was really a consistent double-digit scorer for them. He had a terrible game in the loss to Drexel, which was part of why they got blown out. But the last 10 games, the last regular season, he looked great, and he picked it up where he left off in the regular season on Friday.
Sykes and Clanton are going to cause a lot of problems this year for teams, and it's unfortunate because I think that UCF might be, you know, their starting five might be, you know, maybe behind Memphis, might be as good as anybody else in the league this year in Conference USA. But to my knowledge, I believe they're still ineligible for the tournament this year. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I don't think that was overturned.
I'm pretty sure on that. I'm not 100%. But, we have company, so.
That's going to be unfortunate because they're going to cause some problem with teams, and I think that they're going to have a chance to finish maybe second in Conference USA this year with that starting five, it's not going to do them any good.
Yeah, I understand that they are appealing, and the way the NCAA does things, I mean, what might end up happening is South Florida gets in on the fringes like they did last year, and then, you know, that selection Sunday, Monday, it comes out that UCF is eligible, and then they knock South Florida out of the NCAA tournament, and they're in instead.
That's possible. No, of course you are. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, was there another game you wanted to look at, Lee, on the Saturday slate?
Speaking of Conference USA, Rice isn't a team that's expected to compete in Conference USA, but they've got bigger problems than that. They lost to the Celts of St. Thomas. I believe it's college. I'm not sure because they're not in Division I. 72-59. They were down by 13 at the half. This is not a good sign for the Rice Owls to be allowing 55% shooting to a non-Division I team. So I just wanted to – Saturday had a lot of the body bag games, and one of the bodies in the bag was alive. And St. Thomas upended Rice pretty comfortably. Some of the other ones, Delaware State defeated Gwynedd Mercy College. North Florida beat Edward Waters. That's a school, not a person named Edward Waters. Pacific defeated Holy Names by several dozen. Santa Clara beat up on Simpson University. They could have used OJ. And Northern Iowa more than doubled up Wartburg. So there were some body bag games on Saturday, but it was nice to see St. Thomas stand up for the brothers in the way that Southwest could not against Northern Colorado.
And shame. No discussion on this, but just a cursory shout out to Lee's Fairfield Stags for getting the job done over Central Connecticut.
Yeah, it was good to see that they were able to overcome. And also on Saturday, it's probably not a good sign for Providence's Big East chances that they needed to, 1 point to defeat NJIT. That's probably bad. The Highlanders put up a game fight. That is pretty bad. LaDante Henton led the Friars with 24 points on 20 shots and only one made three-pointer in 8 attempts. So I learned a lot on Saturday about how bad some teams might be this year.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the games from today. We're going to tackle our issue of the week. Just a reminder, everybody, if you'd like to watch college basketball right now, I think there are 2 games going on. There, you've got Montana State and Seattle. That's on the Root Network, which is the Elgin Baylor Classic. I didn't know that they were having that. But then you've also got the regional round of the 2K Sports Classic on ESPNU right now, New Mexico State at Oregon State. And I believe there are more people on the benches than there are in the stands for this game.
Washington's up 10 on Loyola Maryland.
Yes, and that's the Pats on the Pac-12 network. Unfortunately, I don't get that because I have DirecTV. But anyway, let's take a break. We'll come back with more. Stick with us here on the Bracket Racket. We'll be right back.
For the best in news and opinion on Indiana University athletics, check out IU Sportcom. IU Sportcom is the only all-digital, all-sports website dedicated to bringing you the best in coverage of IU football, IU basketball, IU volleyball, IU soccer, and more. IU Sportcom brings you content from the student perspective, including written stories, video reports, podcasts, live broadcasts, and social media. Get the latest Hoosier news at www.iusportcom.com. The only live sports talk show dedicated solely to IU football and basketball is Crimson Cast Live, Wednesdays this fall from 9 to 11 right here on Crimson Cast. Every week we walk you through the keys to the game for your Hoosier squad and bring you interviews with the top writers and reporters covering IU sports today. Plus, Crimson Cast Live takes your phone calls and questions regarding Indiana University athletics at 626-696-8557. Join us every Wednesday night from 9 to 11 p.m. Crimson Cast Live.
Welcome back to the Bracket Racket. Galen Clavio here, joined by Lee Delvecchio, Kyle Lamb, and David Griggs. If you'd like to call in, 626-696-8557. You can also join us in chat. You can tweet at us at CrimsonCast or at HoopsHD. We'd love to hear from you at either of those venues. Got about an hour and 8 minutes left as we're talking college basketball from this opening weekend of the season. And lots still to talk about as we've been through Friday and Saturday. Let's go ahead and tackle some of the games that we've seen today. Kyle, let me toss it to you for a couple of games to start with. The number two and number four teams in action. Louisville beating Manhattan was a little bit of a struggle to start with. They ended up pulling away. They win 79-51. And then Ohio State knocks off Albany 82-60. Thoughts from each of those two games?
Well, I think they're both drinking from the same sour pitcher because both of those teams started just terribly in their respective games against Manhattan and Albany. I'll start with Louisville. Louisville was up 28-19 against Manhattan, and last I saw, at halftime, and last I saw, I think they were shooting in the upper 20% in that game. It was disgusting. But in fairness, they were able to crank up the defensive pressure and get some easy baskets in the second half. And they ended up scoring 51 points in the second half and won 79-51. But, as far as early season games go, Rick Pitino likes to follow that Tom Izzo model of probably not minding his team sucking early in the year. And use it to get better as the season goes along. Because this seemed like the sixth consecutive year that we could be looking at a Louisville team that, looks like they don't even maybe belong in the NCAA tournament. And of course, inevitably, they end up doing that. But if this is going to be the number two team in the country, they're going to have to play a little bit more like they did in the second half and not the first half. And I think this is going to be a great defensive team, but I've still got some questions about their offense, and we certainly saw that manifest itself in the first half. And, jumping up north 71 to Columbus, we kind of saw the same issue early on in the game with Ohio State against Albany. They were actually down by 1 point with, I believe, 5 or 6 minutes to go in the first half. And Thad Mata called a timeout and said some things that are probably a little too vulgar to repeat on air. And, after that time, I think they went on a 15-0 run to finish the first half and wound up winning by, well over 20 points. And, the bad news for Ohio State is they look like are not going to have any post presence to speak of this year. And I just don't think they're going to have any production from the center position. The good news is for them is Aaron Kraft scored 20 points and had 7 assists. And he really looks like he's elevated his offensive game I think that they are going to have three or four consistent scorers. And I've said all along, I think to be a national title contender, you've got to have four guys that can score in a given game. And I think Ohio State's got that this year. It's just not going to come from the post.
David, let me throw a couple of games at you that are different from that one. One that we just saw wrap up, Arizona struggled a bit in their game that they were playing against Charleston Southern, and they were only up four at half. They ended up winning the game 82-73 at home, so a bit of a surprise there. And then on the flip side, Florida playing Alabama State was up 47-9 at half en route to an 84-35 victory. Thoughts from those two games?
Well, I mean, occasionally throughout the course of a half, there's a couple of possessions, maybe two or three, where you have a lapse. And I guess that's what happened to Florida, and that's how Alabama State managed their 9 points. Charleston Southern, I don't understand. I don't avidly watch the Big South, but, I mean, you're used to Coastal Carolina and UNC Asheville. Charleston Southern really hasn't risen to the top. They're one of the two favorites to win this year, along with Campbell, another team that doesn't resonate to the top. So I have to defer to the experts in the Big South that, you know, take the preseason and say that Charleston Southern might actually be good. But even if they are, like, how do you go out to Arizona and give them a game? I was more surprised that Arizona struggled so much with, albeit a good Big South team, the key word there is Big South and not good. Arizona should have buried them. And they just didn't look very good or very composed or, I mean, anything. I was really unimpressed, and it doesn't do anything to change my mind about what I said about the Pac-12 a week ago.
So let's switch a couple more games here. Let me throw these to you, Lee. The first one, Wisconsin, I think, went on a 19-0 run to start their game today. They beat Southeast Louisiana 87-47. And then the other game that I think should be on the radar that was interesting, I watched a little bit of it here earlier on, Georgetown 61, Duquesne 55, in a game that was a real struggle for Georgetown, and in a game that Otto Porter went out with an injury, only played 6 minutes, and if he's injured for any amount of time, that could be a serious problem for the Hoyas.
Yeah, that's a huge injury for the Hoyas. I haven't heard anything yet about it. When I get a minute here, I'm going to try and follow up. I have some Georgetown sources, such as they are, to see if they've got anything. But, you know, it was interesting for Georgetown. They get to play a game on dry land. I missed this discussion, but who would have ever thought playing a game outdoors in the southeastern United States at night might have issues with moisture? I don't know how nobody
missed it. You haven't missed that discussion.
Good.
We saved that.
Good. Yeah. But, yeah, Georgetown, it was a struggle today. And, I mean, today I'm willing to give them a pass because of the Otto Porter issue. But if that's an ongoing concern, and this is what we're going to see, they're going to have problems. The Los Angeles Lakers installed the Georgetown offense, and you saw what that did to Mike Brown. It didn't look much better today against the Duquesne Dukes. It was just terrible to watch. 41% from the field, and that's being generous. The starting five did not shoot very well. It was actually Smith Rivera off the bench for Georgetown who – basically won them the game. He had 19 points. He was 6 of 7 from the field. He hit all four of his threes. So it's great for Georgetown to get the contribution from the unexpected place. But the starting five, they weren't very good. Nate Lubeck wasn't good. Whittington did a great job on the glass. He had 15 rebounds. But if not for his 15 rebounds, they only out-rebounded Duquesne by four. So they shouldn't be relying on just one player. They have a huge size advantage against a team like Duquesne. And yet they didn't do a very good job executing, if I'm honest. Outside of Whittington and Smith-Rivera, they looked very poor. Wisconsin, on the other hand, not the team you would have picked to be up 29-5 at the under 8 of the first half, but they were up 29-5 at the under 8 of the first half. They ran out a 19-0 lead, as you mentioned, Galen, against Southeast Louisiana. Celi isn't very good, so I'm not going to take a whole lot from this, but it was – an out-of-body experience to watch a Wisconsin team be not just efficient offensively, but frequent offensive execution.
I mean, this was
to score this many points was jarring.
Yeah, and they played 14 guys. I mean, they had ridiculous offensive efficiency. Mike Brusewitz, who just recently got cleared to play. I mean, he had had a cut on his leg that had caused some problems for him, but he scored 10 points in 13 minutes of action. You know, they were very efficient. They shot the ball very well. They out-rebounded Southeastern Louisiana 47-17. So that should give you a little bit of an idea of how the game went. But, yeah, I mean,
they in Florida did what – Florida against Alabama State did what they're supposed to do.
Right.
And that makes me – I'm not going to take anything away from Wisconsin, but it's certainly a good sign that they can, without the missing maybe their best player due to injury, to still be able to put this kind of a beatdown on a team they should be putting a beatdown on is a very good sign. It's nothing else.
Yeah, I think we've seen that with a few teams. I mean, we mentioned Indiana earlier on. A couple of other squads really did that. They put the beat down on the team that they needed to. And it's going to be interesting watching how that plays out as we go through these next couple of weeks, because as these teams try to build confidence, I think it's going to be important that they get some big wins under their belt. Baylor's a good example of this also. They had a good game today. They beat Jackson State 78-47, pretty good performance all around. Pierre Jackson had 25 points in that game. They shot over 50%, and a good start for them. They're 2-0 now on the season. North Carolina is the other one, David. 80-56, McAdoo with 19 points and 11 rebounds in that contest. But you know, honestly, the North Carolina, even though they win by 24. I didn't think that they looked quite as good as we might have hoped that they would in that contest.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, it's kind of, going through the rust and all that. But yeah, you got to consider the team that they were playing. You hope that a team ranked that high is going to be more sharp than that. But Baylor, I really think, not to throw it back to earlier, I think Baylor has had the most impressive performance so far. They beat Lehigh. We just got done talked about Bucknell earlier. Lehigh also has all their starters back. They're also very good, and Baylor took them to the cleaners on Friday, and then they looked good again against Jackson State today, so Baylor's looking pretty good.
Right. A couple of games going on right now. Washington playing Loyola. That's on the Pac-12 network right now. Washington's up 57-48 at home. Seattle's up 39-24, pardon me, on Montana State. This Oregon State-New Mexico State game has been a little bit odd. It's been kind of a brutal game thus far, to be honest with you. But Oregon State with a 23-20 lead with about 6 minutes left in the half. And one other score of note, since we're talking about blowouts and teams doing what we were hoping that they would do, Tulsa beating LSU Shreveport 110-54, 29 seconds left in that contest. So good job by the Golden Hurricane there on that. But anyway.
Gail, I've got one just real quick. If you want the weirdest box score of the weekend,
yes,
it is Wisconsin-Milwaukee, South Carolina. I don't know if any of you gentlemen were keeping appraised of the ongoings at the Colonial Life Arena this evening, but let me tell you something. Wisconsin-Milwaukee shot 14 of 33 from three. South Carolina was 0-for-11. South Carolina won 82-75 in overtime.
I hadn't seen that, but you're right. That's an incredible set of statistics there.
It may be nothing else. Another good one is that Mike Martin won as the head coach for Brown University today in his debut. He is the first Brown coach to win his debut since 1941. That's credit to Ivy Hoops Online. So another fun little stat below the radar.
The one other thing I'll throw in from today, Nebraska-Omaha started off pretty good. Who they beat? Northern Illinois on Friday.
Illinois.
They turned around and lost at home to Division II St. Mary. Not St. Mary's, just St. Mary today, 96-86. So
Go ahead, Kyle.
My little tidbit is Marquette, who had to suffer through the cold, chilly condensation game from Friday night that didn't get played, returned home to beautiful Maui, where they were able to play by proxy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at home against Colgate in the Maui Invitational.
Yeah, there have been several Maui Invitational games today, and none of those teams are anywhere close to Maui. It's a little bit disconcerting, but Kyle, what you just mentioned kind of brings us to our issue of the week, and this is something that we were talking about on email. it's been talked about on Twitter a lot through various sources, but it's something that we really would like to chat about, and it is this notion of playing basketball games outside, particularly on aircraft carriers. It took place last year. We talked about it last week, actually, on the Bracket Racket, where it was a cool idea, kind of a one-off thing, and last year's game was interesting. This year, they of course decided, hey, we did one game and it went off fine. Let's have three or four. And so the first game that was supposed to go down was the Syracuse-San Diego State game from Friday. Well, that game never went off on that day. They had to postpone it until today. Then that evening, it really got fascinating and somewhat disturbing as they had to cancel the games in Charleston and in Jacksonville because of condensation issues on the court. So those games didn't happen. One game didn't happen, period. The other game, the Florida-Georgetown game, had to get canceled at halftime. So one half is already played, and that game supposedly is stricken from the record books.
Never happened.
Never happened. You didn't see it, folks. Those of you who were watching on TV, it just didn't happen. And then today, we finally get the playing of the Syracuse-San Diego State game, and it was a fiasco. I mean, it was a cool setting. It was interesting to watch basketball being played in the blinding sunshine, with a strong headwind on one side of the court. But it did not make for good basketball. It gave Syracuse an innate advantage because they play a zone. It required San Diego State to try to shoot from outside, which they can't do anyway, but especially couldn't do because the wind was moving the ball around. Syracuse wins the game. This is supposedly a top 20 matchup between two teams. And it just, you looked at it, the whole thing, not just that game, but the other games that got canceled. And it just drives home the point that however cool the concept is, I just don't think you can play these games outside. We want basketball to be played in a certain set environment where there are confines that limit the parameters that affect what's going on the court. And here you take a lot of those safeguards away, and all the bad things suddenly start happening. Let me start with you on this. It really made for a dissatisfying start to the college basketball season, I think.
Well, I want to see a new NCAA rule implemented. If the game involves having to pack a pair of Oakley shades, a windbreaker, a rain slicker, and a winter coat, then frankly, I don't think it should be scheduled in the first place. Because frankly, those are the conditions that each of these three games had to prepare for. And what's shocking about it is two of these games should have been prepared for it, and they weren't. They're supposed to, like, I was told all along they would have backup plans for if in case the game didn't go off. Well, two of the games didn't finish, didn't happen. You didn't see them. They were never planned. But yet, magically, there were no backup plans. And that's the thing that irritates me the most about this. Okay, I get in both cases the condensation was dangerous. The players shouldn't be playing. I don't think anybody would argue those games should have been played. But, okay, if you're going to go through the trouble of scheduling these games and investing thousands of dollars into planning them and making sure they go off without a hitch, well, what happened to the without a hitch part? I mean, you would think that you would have some competent backup plan to at least play the game if you can't play it outdoors on the deck. And what I was under the impression was that in the case of the Ohio State and Marquette game, that their backup plan was to play the game at the Citadel, which is just 5 miles away from where the aircraft carrier was located. And inexplicably, when they realized that the game was probably not going to be played, it never occurred to anybody, well, why don't we just move everything over to the Citadel where we could probably be set up and ready to play this game in an hour? But that didn't happen. Anybody that thought it was a wise idea to schedule a game, after sundown in, the United States in November, it's just, I question their intelligence.
Lee, let me go to you on this next, because you and I talked a little bit about this on Friday night.
Yeah, it's funny, because I remember being really actually disappointed when originally UConn was supposed to be in the game in San Diego, and then they weren't. And it became another, well, you know what, of course not. We're not probably going to do much this year. I can't blame them in anything. And then UConn was rumored to be in the game in South Carolina, in Charleston. in retrospect, it really couldn't have worked out any better, if I'm honest. Because my issue, I don't know what drives me crazier, that nobody thought moisture would be an issue. These games were played on, you know, a ship docked. I'm okay with San Diego in terms of course, there's no moisture there. It's San Diego. The Southeastern United States, if you've ever been there, folks, there is some humidity there.
I'll verify this. I will verify this independently. Yes.
5 feet off the shore of the Southeast at night in November, the fact that nobody thought of the moisture, I think, is crazy. I think that nobody thought to move it down the road is crazy. I am almost more upset over the San Diego thing. I've thought about it, and here's why. The fact that nobody thought that there might be a sunlight issue in San Diego during the day in November. Like, that one, first of all, you got Jim Boeheim on the sidelines. Looks like he's auditioning for David Caruso's part in CSI, in the shade. That one is crazy to me. How, like, it's a completely different environment during the day. Completely different. I take no measurement from the San Diego State-Syracuse game. That game does nothing to me. You can already see now Jim Boeheim in a month and a half when we have nothing to talk about, screaming at national writers who don't want to give him credit for the win over San Diego State. Because, Jim, you still haven't left New York. This doesn't count. You have to leave New York. Play the Arkansas game counts. You know why? Because you're playing indoors. That's why it counts. It's a very nice idea. I think it's cool. I'm a fan of it. But it's got to go. I'm sorry. We've got – the thing that killed it isn't the idea of playing outside. It's that these places have terrible backup plans or, in some cases, none at all. That's the problem.
All right.
You've got to have a backup plan that's realistic and involves indoors.
All right. Let me get David's take on this situation.
I mean, the thing that kills me is that – in my opinion, if you schedule a game, it has to happen. If it's not going to happen that night and at that time, then it needs to happen at some point. And I guess just to piggyback on what everybody else said, there was no backup plan. I believe, and I spoke with Kyle about this and he confirmed, last year they actually had a second Coliseum built for the North Carolina-Michigan State game, you know, on the ship in case there was problems with the weather. This year, There was no plan. I mean, it's like even in baseball, and where you're subject to the weather, there are rules in place in case you can't play. Not only if you're in the south, if you're in the Southeast United States, not only is it possible, it's probable that you're going to have condensation on the court, that the conditions aren't going to be ideal, and you need a backup plan in place. There weren't any, and I guess what disappoints me is that these were three really intriguing matchups, and two of them are going to be played at any point. And
right.
I guess I realize that, I mean, I guess the gesture is a good one. Like, you want to do this for the troops. You want to do this for the Navy. But I guess, does it mean any less to the Navy if you dock in Charleston and go to the Citadel or the Charleston Arena at CFC to watch the game as opposed to having them come on your ship? I mean, I would imagine if you're living on the ship for weeks and months at a time, it might be nice to get off the ship and go somewhere else.
Well, I think the problem here is I don't know exactly who the organizers were for these events, and that's I just haven't done the research on it. But I feel like they fell in love with the spectacle rather than concentrating on the game, and that's a common mistake that gets made in sports and entertainment over the course of history. I mean, when you're more interested in, ooh, we're going to get these great visuals of this game being played on the deck of this ship rather than, hey, we need to play a damn basketball game because it's on the schedule. And, you know, this may end up being one of the best non-conference games that these teams play. Then I think you really run into problems. And you're right. There should have been backup plans. I think you all hit very nice notes on that. This is where lacking any sort of central command or central, decision-making process in college basketball, I think, really hurts. I mean, this is where if you had a commissioner of college basketball that could make a decision about, okay, this is where we're gonna do the game if the weather does not permit us, because this is not a natural scenario to play college basketball. We don't play games outside. So not having any sort of backup plan, or B, anybody who can come in with decision-making power for the sport and say, yeah, we, you know what, this is great, but if this doesn't work, we're going to go this direction instead. I think it's just a bunch of bad decisions all the way around, and it's disappointing. It really is. And
it really is. And, like, Galen, you and Lee mentioned the Winter Classic that hockey does. Well, they're going to play that game. If for whatever reason, you know, if there's too much snow, like, there are backup plans to play the game like it's sleeting out, aren't there? I would imagine they're going to play that one way or another. The real disappointment isn't that they were canceled. It's that they're not going to be rescheduled. But
right.
These were great games. They were important games.
Yeah, and that's the thing that gets me is that when you start canceling games and not rescheduling them, you start cheapening the individual games, mm-hmm. and particularly games that are, as you said, David, important and are, you know, going to matter at the end of the season when we're looking at committees and deciding whether teams are going to be in the tournament, what seed they're going to be. To just cancel the games and say, oh, you know what, our bad, we're not going to do anything else about it. I mean, what sort of message does that send about the sport? You know, we spent the whole last show, it seems like, talking about trying to legitimize college basketball, because that's really what it's missing. It's missing the feeling of legitimacy that you get with any of the pro sports, with the exception of hockey. And it's missing the feeling of legitimacy that you get with college football. You think college football would have allowed something like this to happen? I mean, somebody would have gotten killed, maybe literally killed, if someone had suggested,
yeah.
Hey, you know, we've got these two ranked teams set to play, but hey, there's weather issues, so we're just not going to play the game. No! That there would have been another option that would have been brought up, even if that option was, hey, we're going to play it tomorrow in a different venue. And because the people who control college football, whether it's at the team level or whether it's at the conference level, seem to legitimately have a clue what they're doing and seem to care about what the process is. And, you know, with college basketball, sometimes I wonder if that's the case.
And there's two groups here that are kind of not being mentioned that I think we have to hold a little responsible here, is that one, the teams involved themselves. What kills me to the point you made is that the teams themselves, to schedule games, to not leave a hole open for today when they could have rescheduled the game somewhere else, to just blindly schedule another game for today is awful to me. And don't tell me, yeah, well, they want to play all these out-of-conference games. There's plenty of time to play the out-of-conference game. You think that today's Duquesne-Georgetown game couldn't have been played? Worst case scenario, they play Monday because they had to reschedule for Sunday, or they play Tuesday instead? To not hold the Sunday open to me is completely irresponsible and ignores Mother Nature, and also the TV networks. I got some hard time for this for some reasons we can't discuss. But seriously, this is the major chance for NBC Sports Network to have they don't have a lot of college basketball available to them. This was their chance to have a major marquee event, arguably the biggest college basketball game they'll have on their network this year. And I don't know that they put pressure to have that game played, but it did not look good. Not only did not have the game played, but you've got Marquette's players on hands and knees mopping the court up. It looks so juvenile and pathetic. And for them to just try and play that game, come hell or high water, I thought didn't look good for the teams. It didn't look good for the networks to not be able to say, hey, no, we've got a backup plan. We're going to go to it. This is stupid. But no, they just held on to it. And the Florida one, thank God it wasn't a blowout at the half, because it's really easy for me to say it never happened when it was a close game. Can you imagine if that game was 45-30 at the half? To have to just ignore a judgment on either of those teams, it would have been impossible.
Right.
And so it goes beyond just the organizers.
And we got some
Well, it's not me.
Kyle, that was Kyle actually feeding back into the call there. Sorry about that.
Anyway,
go ahead.
The teams involved, the programs bear responsibility, and I think the TV networks, to string that along, made it twice as bad. And
right.
To not have the Sunday open to play the game later makes it twice as bad as well.
Kyle, let me go back to you for some final thoughts on this, if we can get your mic to settle down.
Yeah, no, we'll get that taken care of. No, actually, the one thing I was going to say, though, Galen, is I think you're completely right about your thoughts about college football, but I do think one of the other issues is that, like you mentioned, I mean, you guys kind of touched on it, is that one of the other problems with college basketball is that a lot of these non-conference games are put together by third-party promoters. And as we've seen, the same problem with recruiting and in AAU, you get these third party people in, and mm-hmm. they start running the show, and the, these deals are put together with networks by the third party promoters, and the schools oftentimes have basically very little say in how these things go off. And the problem is just that if it were up to the schools themselves, I think they'd think these things through. But the promoters, unfortunately, are the ones that are putting these together, and they're not thinking these through.
You know what? Let me make a cultural reference that only people our age and older will get. College football is like Nintendo in the 80s, and college basketball is like Atari.
Yeah, you know, that's a good one.
I mean, you know, Nintendo in the 80s, they had to personally approve of every single game that was made for the system. And it was very constrictive. It left a lot of people angry because only certain types of games would get made. But all the games were pretty damn good. Atari, yeah, there were millions of games, and some of them were excellent. But there were just as many that were total crap. And I feel like your third-party comment, Kyle, really, it was the same process. You could have a guy or a couple of guys knocking off a game in their garage and publishing it, and you didn't know whether the game you were buying was good or whether it was going to suck. And I don't think it's not necessarily that bad in college basketball, but you get these third-party promoters, and there's no regulation of them. There's no – or limited regulation, at least. There's no way of knowing if they've made all the proper contingencies going into a game. And so not only do you end up with things like what we're seeing now, but you also end up with these fly-by-night tournaments – that end up not having television contracts or end up having fields where the best team is the third place Colonial team, stuff like that. I don't think it's good for the sport.
Yeah.
And then today, I don't know if you guys had seen the way, speaking of marketing, I'm glad Kyle brought this up. Did you see the way this Florida game, the one in Jacksonville, had been marketed? I mean, part of the problem with the marketers is they just jack up ticket prices and they make it out of this big weekend centered around that. In order to get into the game in Jacksonville, you had, speaking of crap, you had to buy Thursday night Jaguars Colts tickets to get a ticket into the game. It was like the way they
packaged it. Are you serious?
Yeah. If you went through the promoter, you had to also buy. I know somebody that went to the game, they didn't go to the football game, but they had to also buy an awful NFL ticket to get into the game. It was similar to the way that the Fiesta Bowl, when they host the national championship a couple of years ago, you had to buy the Insight Bowl and the Fiesta Bowl if you bought the national title game tickets. They draw in. They know how unique the event is, that they gouge people. And when you gouge them that much, the only thing worse is having to give them their money back.
Yep.
And that's what leads to problems like players cleaning the court off in a desperate attempt to play a game that should not be played in the first place.
Anyway, final thoughts on this, we'll leave to IU SportCom and Hoops HD contributor Samantha Daywig, who says, on the record, we just need to eliminate outdoor games, period. Any opposition to that, folks?
Seconded.
Yeah.
How about more games at bases? I mean,
why not?
The players, there are more serving. There are 50,000 people who are serving at Ramstein Air Force Base. That's incredible. And those are active military bases with active military. And I don't mean to belittle the USS Midway, but I don't believe it's an active warship. And it's actually, to me, bastardizing the sacrifice in a way.
Well,
active military bases with active military from the areas where these teams are. Let's bring the games there. And, oh, by the way, they're indoors!
Yeah. I mean, no, and you look around the country. I mean, obviously, Ramstein in Germany is a good place to hold a game, as we saw. I thought that went off very well. There's other overseas bases in Japan, in other areas that you could utilize. But even here in the United States, I mean, you know, whether it's Fort Benning or Fort Hood or Camp Lejeune, there's many different opportunities to do this sort of thing. If you're interested in playing these games for the troops, if you're interested in recognizing Veterans Day as being close to the start of college basketball season, then take advantage of that and do it in an atmosphere and an environment that is a lot more forgiving to college basketball as a whole.
Maybe
I'm old-fashioned, but what about just playing the Naval Academy at Navy and inviting, the troops of USS, fill in the name. I mean,
the problem there, though, is if you're trying to regionalize it, it's hard for people who are – stationed at, you know, in Norfolk to get up to, you know, to Annapolis to watch a game. I mean, it's a lot easier if you bring the game to them. I think that does make some sense. But anyway, so let's take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the games coming up this week, a lot of games coming up this week. This is our last really big pre-holiday tournament week, but there's still some interesting things going on. So let's we'll come back here in about a minute along with Lee and David and Kyle. I'm Galen. This is the Bracket Racket. Stick with us.
Don't get caught on game day with an empty stomach. Fill up on the pregame meal, CrimsonCast's exclusive preview of the upcoming IU football matchup every Friday during football season. Join Mike Petrie as he walks you through the important matchups and statistical storylines for each of IU's football games this campaign. The pregame meal, Fridays on CrimsonCast, a full serving of Hoosier football. Your destination for the best college basketball podcast around is The Bracket Racket. Sunday nights at 9 this basketball season right here on CrimsonCast and on HoopsHD.com. Join Galen, Kyle, David, Lee, and some of the best college basketball minds from across the country as they take you through the most important storylines in the college game. It's The Bracket Racket, your one-stop shop for the best in college hoops. Tune in this basketball season 9 to 11 p.m. on Sundays right here on CrimsonCast.
Welcome back to the Bracket Racket. Galen Clavio here, along with Kyle Lamb, Lee Delvecchio, and David Griggs as we get set for the last 30 minutes or so of the program, and we jump into what we've got coming up this week in terms of matchups. Not a huge amount of strength on strength here this week, guys, but let's just go ahead and go through the schedule. Let's start on Monday. A couple of top 10 teams in action, Indiana hosting North Dakota State. Believe it or not, the first ever meeting between those two schools. Who would have guessed? And IUPUI traveling to Michigan. They will take on the Wolverines at 9 o'clock at night. The IUPUI-Michigan game, part of the NIT tip-off, and North Dakota State-Indiana, part of the Legends Classic, which, you know, it's one of these silly things. I hate this. I really do, even though Indiana's involved in it. You're playing a game that's part of a tournament where only one team will advance regardless of what the actual outcome of the game is. I understand why they do it, but surely, I mean, in a civilized society, David, can't we find a better way of doing this sort of thing?
Yes, we can find a better way, and it's the way they used to do it. The team that won advanced.
I understand there were upsets in the past. There were some problems. And you don't want to lose an Indiana or a Georgetown or somebody like that as a national.
I loved playing Gardner Webb twice in 08, personally.
I bet you did, yeah. But okay. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, you say that, but like one of the game that I think really drew the line in the sand was Gardner Webb's win over Kentucky.
Yes, I believe you're right.
And I forget what tournament it is. But the thing is, that was a big deal, and one of the reasons it was a big deal because Gardner Webb got to play again. A lot of people, you guys are more in the TV than I am, but wasn't that sort of like there was a real buzz going around Gardner Webb as they advanced to play Connecticut?
Well,
let me tell you, there
wasn't,
yes,
and here's why. Because UConn had never played Kentucky in the regular season. They'd only played once in their entire history, and there were a lot of really upset UConn fans, not as much as Kentucky fans, who still had half the tickets and still showed up, by the way. UConn ended up having to play – they played Gardner Webb twice in a 10-day span. The problem wasn't Gardner Webb winning. The problem was that UConn, for God knows what reason – they probably assumed Kentucky would beat Gardner Webb, which seemed like a good idea.
Seemed logical, yes.
But they took the risk. They had also scheduled Gardner Webb later. And on one hand, there's – well, they – they thought they'd be Kentucky. There's 345 other teams you can schedule. You know, they couldn't have gotten Ryder, I mean, instead of Gardner Webb, but they played Gardner Webb twice in 10 days. That's what killed it. It wasn't that Gardner Webb played UConn. It's that UConn was, oh, we got to play this team twice. Schedule someone else. There's lots of options. I completely agree let the winning team advance. It was a good story. You know, let them advance. And,
yeah.
You know, Kentucky, oh, boo-hoo, Gillespie didn't work out. They lived. They survived. You know, let's have a Cinderella story early in the season instead of waiting 6 months.
I think it comes back to what Kyle said, though, about having these third-party promoters handling these things. And when your primary focus is we have to sell tickets to our main event and we can, you know, we have to have teams involved in it, this is what's going to happen. So anyway, we've also got the Tip-Off Classic going on during I think it's starting tomorrow evening, but some interesting games coming out of that. And actually, Kyle, let me have you tackle a couple of these. We've got West Virginia Gonzaga at 11:59 p.m. on Monday. And I'm really curious to see how West Virginia looks, period, but particularly traveling to Gonzaga for this game. It could be quite fascinating.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the 11:59 because I was going to bring that up just for the sheer thrill of it. It's like in order for this to be a marathon, it has to span 24 hours. So we have to make sure it starts at 11:59,
right?
Not midnight, but 11:59.
I think it could have started. No, wait, you're right. It had to start at 11:59. I was about to say it could have started at 12:01, but it couldn't.
Now
you got me confused. So, anyways, I'm really interested to see how this game. I'm not sure what to expect yet from West Virginia. I mean, I know they got Juwan State and the transfer from Dayton, who I like a lot. And I'm really glad that he more people are going to see him. You know, he's going to get a lot of exposure being in the Big East this year because he's a terrific player. But outside of that, and Caligula. And I'm not sure what else, West Virginia is going to have this year. And so it's going to be interesting to me because we talked about Gonzaga a little bit last week and how, you know, I know that there are, you know, some people saying that this might be their best team ever. And I think, I think from top to bottom, I think they've got a balanced roster, but I'm still just not sure how good they're going to be. And I wonder if Gonzaga wins this game tomorrow night, I just wonder if that's not going to like kick up the Gonzaga hype quite a bit. And it might be a little premature with not knowing how good West Virginia is going to be, but I'm really looking forward to this game, though.
Anybody else have a thought on this game?
I echo Kyle's thoughts. I think that Gonzaga is maybe being a little overvalued right now, and a win over West Virginia will surely only help that overvaluing. I have a game I'm looking forward to more in this marathon that I will not be awake live for. But
Davidson, New Mexico.
No, that's not the one. I'm excited, actually. Stony Brook Rider could be really interesting. I mean, Stony Brook was picked preseason second in America East. Meanwhile, you've got Rider, who just absolutely beat the tar out of Robert Morris. They beat him by 25
right
on Friday. And, you know, it's 6 a.m. It's a little early. I'm excited for the game, but it's kind of like the outdoor game. It's hard to take too much from it, but I think this will actually be a really good game. I think these are two decent teams facing off at a very early hour, obviously. I will be DVRing it, but that is a game I'm actually looking forward to in the marathon that's going to get absolutely no love. This isn't an early game for the sake of an early game. These are two teams that I think are actually kind of decent and they've made some noise in postseason tournaments the last couple of years Ryder with Justin Thompson was a tough team to beat.
Right.
So there's something there with those two teams. The 8 a.m. game features a team that lost to Nebraska Omaha, so I don't care. I mean, Valparaiso might beat them by 30.
I think, the most excited about the Davidson-New Mexico game. Davidson obviously has gotten a lot of love, David, and it's deserved. I mean, they've got everybody back. They should be a very good team. I think New Mexico, for like the fourth year in a row, is getting criminally underrated going into the season. And they have a very tough venue, the Pit. I mean, we've all heard about it, but they play very well there. They have in previous years, and I think it's just going to be a dynamite basketball game at 2 a.m. on Tuesday.
Yeah, and it really will be. And it's actually, I think, tipping at 11:59 local time. It's bizarre. Midnight is sort of like the 666 of the NCAA. You cannot, you have to start everything before midnight.
unless it starts after midnight. So 11:59 and 12:01 are acceptable.
Right.
That's, I didn't mean to confuse you earlier, but Davidson at New Mexico in the pit, not on an aircraft carrier. It is sort of a gimmick, but it's a gimmick that enhances the game. Like, that is going to be a dynamite atmosphere, sold out between two really good teams that, like you said, like, are criminally underrated, but both very good. Yeah, this is an important at-large caliber game.
Yeah.
And it's going to be awesome. That's the one I'm looking forward to the most.
All right, so let's...
This is at Hawaii, that right after that. But, yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, if you want to go... If you want to go really, like, third level in terms of some of the matchups on Monday, there are some really remarkable pairings. I mean, you got Radford's taking on Cincinnati Christian. Wofford's taking on Weber International. South Carolina Upstate is taking on, I think it's Hiwassee. Or Hawassi, one of the two. I'm not sure what the pronunciation there is.
You better mention NJIT's game, or so help you God.
I hadn't seen it. Who are they playing?
They are hosting the Eastern Nazarene College.
Oh, wow. I was actually the most excited by North Texas taking on Alabama Huntsville, because Alabama Huntsville, what's the trivia on them, Lee, that very few people know about?
Oh, that they have the greatest college hockey program in the state of Alabama?
That is correct. They have the only college hockey program.
Yeah, they never added football in the 70s because they realized we could be dumb like UAB, sorry, and add the 15th college football team in Alabama, or we can have the only hockey program. They've won Division II national championships in ice hockey.
Yes, they have.
And as a result,
they're
no longer a Division II in ice hockey.
yeah.
But they've won it.
They no longer have ice hockey.
Well, Division II doesn't. Alabama Huntsville, I think they're still trying to.
No,
to
it was canceled. It was canceled 2 years ago. The Board of Trustees shut it down.
That's a shame.
Well, they clearly.
How about the return of Centenary to major college basketball facing TCU Monday night?
Yeah, that deserves a big round of applause.
The return and departure of Centenary to major college basketball. Speaking of things that are hardly...
Hold on. One at a time. Go ahead, Lee.
Oh, I was just going to mention the Haverford-Columbia matchup of people who will be running this country in a matter of 5 years, but be very bad at basketball.
Now, we need to move forward. We got a lot of basketball to talk about on Tuesday. We've talked about a few of them already, but let's tackle the rest of the games. Of course, the games going on throughout the course of the day are interesting. You've got... I mean, the big name game, I guess, or in the early going, it's actually at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Butler at Xavier. Neither of these teams is what they were even a couple of years ago, but I think it should still be an intriguing contest. And I don't know if it's going to have NCAA implications, because I don't know if – I mean, Butler probably will be in the mix. I don't know that Xavier necessarily will be. But interesting. Now, David, does this count as a conference game?
It does not. The two play again. It's the very last game of the regular season. What happened was, and I'm sure Butler, this is their first year in the Atlantic 10. This game was scheduled over a year ago before it was known Butler was going to join the Atlantic 10 as part of the tip-off.
Okay.
So it is two teams in the same conference playing a non-conference game.
Beautiful.
It is interesting. Another thing, these two teams have developed a lot of bitterness toward each other. I don't really know why.
They had that incident a couple of years ago with the clock, right?
Yeah, and that certainly didn't help. And, well, Butler had beaten Xavier twice, and Xavier doesn't like to get beat. And then Butler advanced to back-to-back national title games, and Xavier doesn't like to see anyone accomplish something that they can't. So I think a lot of it is jealousy. But Xavier does not like Butler, and Butler does not like being not liked. So, I mean, this is really interesting. I mean, I think Dayton was largely considered to be Xavier's biggest rival within the conference. I guess their biggest rival overall is Cincinnati. And,
right.
You know, every now and then you have a big brawl. But these teams, these schools, and these fans really dislike each other. And
yeah.
They're playing each other at 3 o'clock in the after 4 o'clock. I'm sorry, in the afternoon.
Because
it doesn't matter, but it matters to them.
Anyway, let's Kyle, a couple of games before we get to the big games on Tuesday, a couple of games that I think are worth noting. Long Beach State traveling to USC. You like the 49ers in this game?
Yeah, I do. But that's probably damning with faint praise because given who they're facing, I'm not sure that I know Long Beach has, you know, lost a little bit from last year's team, but they're still, I think they've got more flat out talent than USC. So yeah, I like them to win this game, probably by, you know, 8 to 10 points actually.
Okay.
I don't know if I like Long Beach State, but I certainly hate USC enough to pick Long Beach State.
Kyle, another one for you, a battle of two teams that picked up somewhat surprising victories against BCS conference competition. George Mason travels to Bucknell at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. That should be a pretty intriguing game. And I guess in that same kind of bracket buster mode, Wichita State at VCU, same time, same tip-off. That game's going to be on ESPNU.
Yeah, that's the game. I'm glad you mentioned that one. That's the one I'm really looking forward to. I like Bucknell to win that. I'm going to stay on my Bison love, and I'm going to insist that that wasn't a huge upset against Purdue. But I'm glad you mentioned the Wichita State VCU game because I'm really looking forward to. I know Wichita State is not going to be, you know, the top 25 team that they were last year, but I'm really anxious to see both of these two teams play in a what's surely going to be a great environment at VCU. This is going to be a great early season test for both of them.
Lee, we've got one other afternoon game, actually two other afternoon games that might be somewhat of note. First, Temple taking on Kent State. Now, is Temple, remind me of this, are they transitioning to the Big East next year or the year after?
They're in next year, in which they join a cast of thousands, including Southern Methodists. I believe Central Florida joins in non-succeeding odd-numbered years that have 13 Thursdays in the month of January. And Navy gets in, but we just don't like to talk about it. Navy, thank God, is not joining for basketball. That's all I know from the whole thing, because that
right.
would be painful. In terms of, yeah, no, Temple's not in the A-10 this year, to answer the question you asked. Temple, we'll have to see if Temple isn't looking ahead to Rice. After this afternoon result, I doubt that's happening. This is one of the few, actually. Temple has a good out-of-conference schedule, but it's all back-loaded. The first five games of the year for them are pretty brutal.
Right.
Rice, Delaware, Buffalo, Wagner, which sounds like a bad law firm out of Philadelphia more than out of conference schedule. Those five, they will hopefully prepare them for games against Villanova, who had, I thought, a really good win today against Marshall, and then Duke, and then later Syracuse and Detroit, and at Kansas, leading into Xavier St. Louis to start the A-10. So Temple is trying to hit the ground running here. This is their first game of the year. They've got to come out and show something in this game because they don't have a lot of room to work with the schedule.
Lee, another one that I wanted to get your thoughts on, Detroit at St. John's. Now, obviously St. John's, you know, a dream year 2 years ago, nightmare year last year. Where does this year fall in between those two extremes?
I think it actually, the more I think about them, the more I like them, just because the Big East is kind of weak in the bottom half, as we discussed. And there's talent on this roster, more than I can say for Seton Hall or Providence or DePaul, or you could even argue Connecticut in certain positions being all but the 1 and 2. So I think St. John's has a chance to make some noise. They do not have a very good out-of-conference schedule. I mean, it is a brutally bad out-of-conference schedule for St. John's. Detroit is far and away the best out-of-conference game they will play. I still like Detroit in this game because they've got Ray McCallum, and he will be, I think, by far the best player on the court. They went out, they played, I don't even know who this abbreviation is, Northern Michigan. I should know who this is, Northern Michigan,
yeah.
Which is a solid CCHA team, but not a very Division I basketball team. And Detroit went out and they beat him by 35. And I think this is the chance for Ray McCallum Jr. on the national stage again to reestablish himself and be that guy that people remember. And I don't think St. John's can stop him. The question is, will St. John's do the smart thing and let Ray McCallum get his 30
and worry about the other four guys on the court, or are they going to stupidly try and shut him down, which will leave a lot of guys wide open? And if they're leaving people open, I think Detroit obviously has a good chance to win this game. I think St. John's will be one of the better teams at the bottom half of the Big East, but I still think Detroit is the better team in this game, and I think Detroit should win this game. And it's going to be tough for St. John's, by the way, to get a lot of atmosphere at the Carneseca Arena. It's 2 p.m. on a Tuesday in New York, and the game's in Queens. There's not going to be a lot of energy. I really wish this was one of the late-night games, like the 10 o'clock tip or the 9 o'clock tip. That place would have been jacked up. 2 in the afternoon is going to be dead.
Is there no – like, I mean, obviously St. John's plays their big games at Madison Square Garden. They play the rest of the games in Jamaica. Is there no intermediate arena that we could find for them to play games in for a game like this?
That's the way New York is. It's either the biggest place on earth or the 3,500-seat Carneseca Arena. There is an in-between venue, but even the Islanders don't want to play there anymore. So there's really no other options. I don't want to send them to Nassau. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But there's really no other option. No, it's funny. They go either 19,000 or 3,400. This is why when they're not very good, UConn and Syracuse have 10,000 people in the building.
Fair enough. Let's go ahead, David, and launch into the two big games on Tuesday. And let's start with Duke, Kentucky. This is part of the State Farm Champions Classic in Atlanta. We've obviously seen Kentucky already. We've seen Duke. Kentucky's played in a slightly more meaningful game. What would you anticipate in this contest? Or, I mean, at this point, were you scared off by the way that Kentucky played in that first game, or how would you rate them against the Blue Devils?
I would rate them somewhere around, after running numbers, I would rate them somewhere around not nearly as good.
Very fine.
I just really, I mean, I know it was Georgia State, and I know that they were at home, but Duke actually looked like they knew what the hell they were doing. They looked cohesive, and I guess that's what I'm looking for. Kentucky didn't. And I'm not, Maryland's no pushover, but Maryland isn't a top 20 team, and Kentucky still struggled to beat them, and as it was emphatically pointed out, they probably shouldn't have beaten them. I think Duke is going to win, and they're going to win huge in that game. And again, I don't think it's indicative necessarily of how good Kentucky is going to be at the end of the year, but right now, on that night, at that place, they're not anywhere nearly as good as Duke is.
Can I piggyback off that point?
Go ahead, please.
In regards to my earlier point about Kentucky relying on Jared Paulson, Duke will win this game because if there's one thing Duke knows, it's overachieving Caucasian combo guards. So Jared Paulson doesn't stand a chance in this one. Duke wins.
That's like the thesis paper of Duke basketball last 30 years.
Wow. Okay. Anything else you'd like to say about the game, Kyle?
There's no easy transition from that.
No, I just really
Georgia
wanted
State's
to make
not bad. I mean, that's the thing. Georgia State's not bad. They're probably not NCAA tournament good, but they're not bad, and Duke crushed them.
Yeah, that's true. Well, anyway, well, it's all right. Well, I'm curious to see. I happen to think Kentucky probably plays a lot better than they played in that first game. I think that it was a weird entryway into that game for Kentucky. Everybody really showered a lot of praise on Calipari for the having his players do the telethon thing to raise money for Sandy victims. And I think that was a great humanitarian idea. I don't know how great of a basketball idea it was, simply because here you've got a new team, a team that hasn't really played together up to this point. You're on a big stage, you're on national television, you're in an arena you're not familiar with, and you don't have your guys focused the whole time going into the game. I think that backfired a little bit. I don't think they'll have that distraction moving forward into this game. They're going to have no problems getting fired up to play Duke. And I was impressed by what I saw out of Duke in their first game, but I think that you're dealing with a team that's on their same plane, and I'm curious to see if everybody's commentary that this year's Duke team can't be nearly as bad defensively as they were last year, if that's really the case or not. So we'll see at least a little bit here early on in this contest.
I'm excited for Nerlens Noel, Mason Plumlee. I hope they match up you know, on the low block. That could be really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be the biggest hair disparity in the history of college basketball.
And that might not be the best big man playing in that building that night.
That's true, because why?
Oh, God, for some reason I thought Indiana was in that tournament. After that. Let me assure you, it will not be Derek Nix if it's the same one that showed up in Western Europe.
Well, that was what I was – I thought you were going there, and I was like, that doesn't make sense. But anyway.
Not that Derek Nix will be better than either of them. No. The other game, of course, is Michigan State, North Carolina.
It's Michigan State, Kansas.
Kansas. Yes. Oh, God.
Take a five-minute break, okay?
Yeah,
you self-cross-checked yourself there. But no, Michigan State ranked 14th, I think they're still 14th, actually, versus Kansas. Kansas ranked 7th. Kansas won their first game. Michigan State, of course, lost to UConn, better opponent than what Kansas faced. But Kyle, you know, putting aside their eventual Final Four berth, Michigan State did not look great in that Connecticut game, and Kansas might not be the best matchup for them this time around.
Yeah, no. If they had problems with Connecticut and, you know, giving them backcourt pressure, and Connecticut does not have the front court that, you know, that Kansas has this year. I mean, Kansas, they're not an overwhelming front court, but they do have Jeff Withey inside, and Michigan State couldn't even get the ball inside. So I can't imagine what Kansas is going to do to them. I really like this Kansas team a lot. I'm still a little skeptical as to where the score come from, but they're going to be a good team defensively. And, you know, with Perry Ellis and Jeff Withey, they've got a good front court. You know, Ben McLemore looked good in their first game. He's a good shooter, you know, passes the ball really well. I think this is going to be a tough defensive team for Michigan State, and I don't see the recipe being too much better Tuesday night against Kansas. I really like the Jayhawks in this one.
I tend to agree with you on that. I think that for every reason that you said, I really have nothing of note to add to that. So let's jump forward. Let's tackle Wednesday. Not that many games going on, but David, the one game between two ranked opponents, Wisconsin versus Florida, kind of a contrast in styles here, and given the way both of these teams have started the season, one that could be quite fascinating to see who's able to prevail, at least on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, and it's really hard to tell too much from the two teams that they did open the season against, but I really like Florida in this one. I mean, Florida is one of my Final Four teams. Wisconsin, while good, they're dealing with injuries and not having their full roster and going through some adjustments. I just think Florida is the superior team. Wisconsin is good, but they're not as good as Florida.
Other games of note from that slate on Wednesday, there aren't very many, quite frankly. We do have UAB at Creighton, and, of course, we've also got a couple other major conference teams in action, Liberty taking on Georgetown, Presbyterian, and Georgia Tech. And really, folks, that's about it. So jumping ahead to Thursday of this week, top five teams in action. We got Sam Houston State, Indiana. We got Samford and Louisville. That is a Battle for Atlantis game. And then, Lee, we've got North Carolina State traveling to Puerto Rico. They take on Penn State in the first round of the Puerto Rico tip-off. Your thoughts on that?
Look. If NC State wants to actually get my attention, they'll go out there and they'll beat Penn State by 25. Because contrary to what Kyle says, Penn State isn't that good. What I anticipate will happen is that this will end up being a close game, and everyone will say what a good test it was for Mark Godfrey's boys that they got a good close win out of the way. They should blow a team like Penn State out if they are a legit top 10 team. This should not be closed. It should be unfit for television. I don't think that will happen, though, because it's early. Not just because I don't think they're top 10. I also think it's early in the season.
Right.
And you're flying kids down into what's a very nice environment. You want to make sure their minds are focused on the game. It's tough. They're flying not out of the country, but off the mainland. It can be hard sometimes to keep their attention, younger kids. You know they're going to – it'd be very hard to not underestimate Penn State, let's be honest, based on what we saw last year and what the expectations are for NC State.
I am really focused more than the result, though, on how NC State attacks this game mentally. If they look fully engaged, if they come out all, you know, full business-like, if they go out there and they're just lackadaisical and they're trying to throw alley-oops, it's not going to be a very good sign. This is the kind of game they've got to just put to bed early and work on the plays that they're going to need to execute late in the ACC season.
We seem to have lost Kyle, so hopefully we can get him back before the show ends.
He would have talked about how Penn State's going to get a one seed.
Well,
but
Penn State and NC State, of course you lost him.
Well, David, I'll throw the question to you that I was going to throw to him. The other three games in the Puerto Rico tip-off, you have Providence and UMass. You've got UNC.
Wait for that one.
You've got UNC Asheville at Tennessee. And then you've got Oklahoma State and Akron. You would think, I guess, in this setup that you'd have to be NC State and Tennessee in the championship game, right? I mean, do you see anybody else coming close to those two teams?
Not really. I'm curious about Akron, but I'm not sure this is the proper measuring stick. I mean, it's like when you're trying to run a mile, don't judge someone when they try and run a marathon. I think Akron's a little over their heads. But, yeah, Tennessee and NC State, and I really like this Tennessee team. There have been other teams that I said that I like that have already disappointed me. Tennessee isn't one of them. I think that this is a very good Tennessee team. I'm very curious to see how they do in this tournament, particularly against NC State, because I'm not big on them.
Galen, if you want to see that might make noise in this tournament. I mean, UMass isn't actually that bad. They bring back four starters. They have their top four scorers, nine of their top 10 rebounders. They're a team that has NCAA tournament aspirations. And
right.
While UMass Providence is such an awful game, we don't allow it to be played in New England this year. I think UMass is a team that could blow up that bracket. It wouldn't surprise me, especially if NC State's head is right up their own ass.
Okay, so
how is that bracketed? Assuming UMass wins, who do they get?
Let me look it up. But we got Kyle back. Kyle, we're looking at the Puerto Rico tip-off and the field as a whole. Outside of NC State and Tennessee, anybody else that you see making noise down there during this tournament?
I see plenty of noise being made, but it's not the good kind. I like Tennessee to win that tournament, actually. And, you know, I've been championing NC State this year, but I actually like Tennessee to pull the upset in that tournament.
Okay. Well, the bracket, the way that it plays out, it would probably be Oklahoma State, Tennessee in the semifinal, and then NC State and either UMass or Providence. Nobody gives any love to Oklahoma State in this? You don't think they have a chance of maybe making it to the championship game?
I don't think they're as good as UMass. They might be as good as UMass. I don't think they're as good as Tennessee or NC State.
Okay. All right.
And
so,
I'm sure Penn State maybe to Kyle. But.
We do have a couple other things going on. We've got the Charleston Classic going on Thursday and another kind of strange lineup. We've got Baylor-Boston College. We've got Dayton-Colorado. We've got St. John's and Charleston. And then we've got Auburn and Murray State. Can somebody salvage something from this for me?
Yes, I really like this College of Charleston team. I think they're going to win their first game, and obviously Murray State has most of their elements back, so that's an intriguing semifinal. Dayton, Colorado is a toss-up. I'm still trying feeling them out. Colorado had a strong finish last year, but I believe half of their roster is freshmen. And they beat Wofford, but Wofford, you know, a good SoCon team, but they traditionally start out awful, so not a lot to be told there. But Baylor has really stuck out to me. I realize Isaiah Austin got hurt against Lehigh, and he didn't play today. But I don't know what his status is for that tournament. But if he is back, I think Baylor wins it without sweating too much.
All right. We got about a minute left, so just a couple other things I wanted to touch on. We got the Coaches versus Cancer Classic in Brooklyn coming up on Friday, BYU, Florida State. We've got a few other games scattered throughout. Wake Forest taking on UConn at the Paradise Jam at St. Thomas. That is must-watch television. And then a few other games.
This might be the only trophy UConn wins.
It might be.
Hey, we got the one in Germany.
You got Vanderbilt, Oregon, Illinois, Hawaii. Any other games or any other things that you're looking forward to this week, guys? We've got about 40 seconds. Kyle, you first. Okay.
Sorry, I muted myself. No.
Fine.
Nothing really stands out to me on the schedule this week.
David?
No.
Okay. That's great. Lee?
Oakland at Pitt's the kind of game Pitt loses when they aren't very good. They got to be able to win that game.
I absolutely agree. Well, folks, thanks for listening in. We're out of time here on the Bracket Racket. We'll be back next. Actually, we might not be back next Sunday. Check our program listings on Crimson Cast on Hoops HD. For Lee, David, and Kyle, I'm Galen. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you on the flip side. So long, everybody.